Conan O'Brien has a new gig. Well, two new gigs. Tonight he opens a two-month stand-up comedy tour in Eugene, Oregon. And cable station TBS just announced that in November, Conan O'Brien will take their 11 p.m. slot Monday through Thursday. O'Brien was, of course, shoved out of The Tonight Show on NBC earlier this year. Well, here to talk about all this is Andrew Wallenstein of The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi there.
I understand that this took a lot of people by surprise.
Oh, completely. I mean, all the reporting in recent days or weeks has had Conan O'Brien going to Fox. There has been so much analysis of this, and lo and behold, TBS comes out of nowhere and lands Conan.
How did they do this?
Well, I'm sure money had a lot to do with it. Ultimately, one of the things that was being reported regarding the Fox deal that was in the works was he was going to get less money than he was getting at NBC. And my guess is, although this hasn't been finalized or confirmed, is he's going to get a deal through TBS comparable, if not more so, than he was getting at NBC.
Now, Conan O'Brien has made his own announcement on Twitter. It says, "The good news, I'll be doing a new show on TBS starting in November. The bad news, I'll be playing Rudy on the all-new Cosby Show." Conan O'Brien has built a new persona for himself in the Twitter universe.
Yeah, he has. It's kind of been an interesting thing, given, you know, this has sort of been his way of speaking to the masses, not necessarily every day, but in the absence of a talk show, it's not bad to do your thing on Twitter.
Now, there's another late night, or at least not all too late, let's say evening host on TBS, George Lopez. How's he doing?
Well, George will still be on TBS. He's actually moving back an hour. And the interesting thing to read about this report this morning was that Lopez was actually instrumental in bringing Conan over. And that's actually smart, because even though he's moving back an hour, he's going to have a much more solid lead-in. I wouldn't be surprised if he had more viewers at midnight than he was having previous at 11.
Is this the kind of thing that could make a cable network attracting a well-known personality like this?
Well, I would hesitate to say make in the case of TBS. TBS is kind of one of cable's best-known secrets. It's this quiet giant that's been doing audience levels comparable to broadcast television for quite a while. I think adding Conan is sort of the cherry on top for them. In the sense that if you were to think of cable as sort of like a classroom, TBS isn't exactly the cool kid, but I think this will go a long way in improving its cool credibility.
So who's he up against in this time slot?
Well, 11 o'clock means is significant for what he's not up against, which is, you know, the Letterman, Leno, traditional players in the world. I mean, that was also one of the reasons he didn't go with the Fox deal ultimately, was that he would have been on at all different times around the country, and he may not even necessarily been on in around the country. TBS levels that playing field, 11 o'clock everywhere.
You know, there's an adage, I guess, in the entertainment world that you have to be present. You have to stay in front of your audience. And he's had quite an absence now from the small screen. That Twitter account that we were talking about earlier, is that what's helped keep him alive and keep him in touch with his fans in that interim period? And will that make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, let's be clear. A Twitter account is nowhere near the kind of exposure a broadcast late-night TV show gives. But I think it's a combination of both Twitter and the fact that he's doing these live comedy shows now that shows that, I mean, Conan, I think, really came out of this whole controversy with NBC with some newfound momentum. And it was key that he continued to ride that and will continue to ride that until we see him on TBS in November.
Andrew Wallenstein, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Wallenstein is a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Allen Iverson of the Philadelphia 76ers has had a newsworthy NBA career. He was once named the league's most valuable player and also had trouble with police and his teams. A new ESPN documentary describes Iverson's youth when he played Virginia high school basketball and football.
What do you got to say as a junior to come and win a state championship? It's got to feel pretty good.
Gonna go get one in basketball now, that's all.
Okay, congratulations.
Iverson did win a championship in basketball. The documentary shows a young man from a home with no father. His mother was often absent. Still, he became a high school star until he was sent to prison. Allen Iverson's trial is the focus of the film No Crossover. It's directed by Steve James, whose previous movies include Hoop Dreams. This film took James back to his hometown, Hampton, Virginia.
I come from a community where sports is king, and Allen Iverson was probably the most phenomenal high school athlete to come from my community, both as a football and basketball player. And so for this athlete to so divide the community, I just thought there must be something larger at work here than just a simple fight in a bowling alley, even a racial fight.
Well, you mentioned the division there. Let's talk a little bit about that division and start perhaps with the undisputed facts that no one disagreed about in Virginia.
The only facts that no one, I think, disagrees about is that there was a fight in the bowling alley and it was racial.
In all the chaos, a home video camera captures only a few brief moments of the brawl.
There are people who are picking up chairs in this bowling alley and smashing them down on people. It's an ugly-looking fight.
It is an ugly-looking fight, yes. As to what precipitated it, Allen Iverson and three of his black friends said that this white bowler named Steve Forrest called Allen the N-word. Of course, Steve Forrest, who's passed away now, so I couldn't speak to him, he said at the trial that Allen Iverson really was the one that started the fight. He was minding his own business, and Allen came over and provoked him.
And you show some footage from the courtroom as Iverson is sentenced to a total of 15 years for this brawl in which, although it was ugly, no one was that seriously injured. Is that correct?
That's right. And what's interesting is that the charge that Allen and his co-defendants were charged with was this statute called Maiming by Mob, which was put on the books in Virginia after the Civil War to protect blacks from lynching. And one of the things about the Maiming by Mob statute is that it allowed Allen and the other defendants to be charged with basically just being present at the brawl. And of course, it needs to be said that none of the white participants in the bowling alley brawl were charged.
How did the brawl and the resulting sentence of this great star, Allen Iverson, divide the broader community?
Well, I think, you know, that's what the film really tries to investigate. And Allen was this transcendent star. I mean, when Bethel, his team, played Hampton High School, which was my alma mater, in basketball, they filled a 10,000-seat arena. And there were many black and white faces in those crowds. So he was hugely popular. But along with that, there was this undercurrent that Allen Iverson was an arrogant athlete. He was a guy that got away with whatever he wanted to get away with. He didn't have to go to school. So I think what happened is that when this brawl happened, many people, mostly in the white community, but not exclusively, felt, you see, this is the kind of kid this guy is. Whereas many of the people in the black community, but not exclusively, felt that they were trying to make an example of this kid. They were charging him as an adult, and they were determined to not let that happen.
A Hampton courtroom was packed with friends and supporters of Allen Iverson. A judge convicted Iverson. After
several ministers and civic groups have started a legal defense fund called SWIFT.
Now, you said that blacks and whites in your part of Virginia saw this case differently. Was this a community that was already divided in some way?
Yes. I mean, it is the South. I tell a story in the film when I played at Hampton High School about when we had pep rallies. All the black students sat on one side and all the white students sat on the other side. And when a white player was introduced, the white side would cheer. And when a black player was introduced, the black side of the gym would cheer. And so some of the underlying tensions that trace all the way back to the fact that Hampton, Virginia is where slaves first were brought to America. People said this case caused more division within the community of blacks and whites than at any time since the assassination of Martin Luther King. And this is just a bowling alley brawl in which three or four people suffered basically minor injuries.
How did it affect your film that although a number of people spoke with you in Hampton, Virginia, the central character, Allen Iverson, did not?
Well, when I talked to ESPN about doing this film, I said to them, I don't think he will participate in this film because I don't think he wants to go back and revisit this. Allen not participating allows us to focus the film much more on the community than we might have if Allen was a part of it. But on the other hand, I would love to sit down and talk to Allen Iverson about what happened. And I don't really want to know about what happened in the bowling alley. I mean, I don't want to ask him all the questions about where were you and where did you really leave or stay and what happened and all of that. I'm really interested to just talk to him about the place he's from, that we're both from. And then when this happened, how did that change the way he looked at his community and the way he looks at himself?
Well, if you did get a chance to talk with Allen Iverson and you asked him how this incident changed his view of his community, maybe he would turn around and ask you the question I'm about to ask you, which is how did it change your view of that same community as a white man?
You know, I think I had the impression over the years that I knew more about my community than I did. Going back and doing this film really educated me, not only just about the history, but also about the relations between blacks and whites in this community, and especially about the black community of Hampton. I got to meet people who I had never even heard of, and any self-respecting person from Hampton should have known who these people, you know, are. And I had no idea who these people were.
The ESPN documentary by Steve James is called No Crossover, The Trial of Allen Iverson. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
We mentioned that Allen Iverson was sentenced to 15 years. He served 4 months. Douglas Wilder, the nation's first black governor, commuted his sentence, and the Virginia Court of Appeals overturned it. You can find scenes from No Crossover at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Biographer Kitty Kelly has published tell-alls about Jackie Onassis, Frank Sinatra, and both George Bushes. Today, her 524-page unauthorized biography of Oprah hits the shelves. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Oprah Winfrey comes into American living rooms every weekday, and she's famous for getting the hard to get, like Elizabeth Edwards, who talked to Winfrey first about the affair her husband John had while he was running for president.
You asked your husband for just one gift when you got married. What was that?
I wanted him to be faithful to me.
Did you believe that this was the only time?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I believed.
Only time with her?
Only time with her.
But as much as Winfrey talks to other people, she's famous for not allowing people who know or work for her to talk about her. Her strict non-disclosure mandates are legendary. Winfrey no longer gives interviews that she can't control, and when asked for comment on Kitty Kelly's book, her spokeswoman, Lisa Halliday, gave NPR the same one-line response that has been given to everyone else who inquired. Oprah hasn't participated in or read Kitty Kelly's book, so she is unable to comment. Follow-up questions were ignored. So writer Kitty Kelly was faced with a considerable task when she decided to do an unauthorized biography of daytime television's Queen of Talk. Kelly said Winfrey was intriguing in part because she was such a huge challenge, a bigger challenge even than the members of a powerful political dynasty.
I didn't just jump into this project. I really wanted to do a full-dimensional biography, and Oprah Winfrey was the only life story I wanted to do after the Bushes.
Kelly says getting her publisher to sign on to the project wasn't easy. After all, beginning in 1996, the Oprah Winfrey Book Club had been a crucial shot in the arm for the publishing industry for more than a decade. An Oprah endorsement can sell millions of copies. And it's not just good for books. She stumped for Barack Obama in 2008 at the Iowa caucuses.
So much has been said about what my jumping into this arena does or does not bring to the table of politics. I really don't know.
Eventually, Kelly got a green light for the book, but Winfrey, like Kelly's other celebrity subjects, wouldn't agree to be interviewed. So if the subject herself isn't going to talk, how do you do it?
For this book, although I interviewed 850 people, and I did not personally interview Oprah Winfrey, the biggest source of information in the book and the best source of information was Oprah herself.
Kelly began gathering information from thousands of Winfrey's past public utterances.
I spent about a year assembling every interview the woman ever gave in the United States and the United Kingdom in the English language on radio, television, newspapers, and magazines.
She also got two of Winfrey's family members, her stepfather Vernon and her cousin Catherine Carr Esters, to speak, and had photos taken with them and included in the book as confirmation. Oprah, a biography, doesn't contain any explosive revelations, but it does flesh out many of the things Winfrey has mentioned about her past. The sexual abuse she said she endured as a child, a traumatic adolescent pregnancy, a heavy flirtation with drugs, and the nature of the relationship with best friend Gail King. Kelly did do a two-part interview with Matt Lauer on Monday and this morning on the Today Show, but David Drake, spokesman for her publisher, Crown Books, a division of Random House, says rumors that other media outlets have declined interviews are true. Drake won't name names, but reportedly ABC is one of them. ABC's parent company, Disney, is partnering with Winfrey in several of the new shows she'll present on the Oprah Winfrey Network.
If they're deciding the merits of a book's newsworthiness on the basis of whether or not it might offend one of their corporate partners, it's an abdication of the primacy of letting the news value dictate the news.
NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik, says that's a sign of how interconnected much of modern media has become. He says Winfrey's stature has made her untouchable in many parts of the broadcast media.
She is clearly a unparalleled influential voice in media, that presidential candidates, that Oscar candidates, that people who have a message they want to get out to the public are desperate to have the attention and the good graces of.
Random House is betting that readers will be braver than some media outlets have been. Their initial run of Kelly's Oprah book is 550,000 copies. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
And you can read an excerpt of the Oprah biography at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In Japan, there's been a recent surge in visitors to shoguns' castles, samurai battle reenactments, and history bookstores. Besides being history buffs, many of these visitors have something else in common. They're women. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Tokyo on the rise of the history girls.
One of the more public faces of the Rekijo, or history girls, is a fashion model named Anne. She's the daughter of actor Ken Watanabe, and she goes by just one name. She's carved out a niche for herself writing and speaking about history and history buffs. Rekijo all have their favorite historical periods and characters. Speaking in a Tokyo cafe, Anne says hers is the Shinsengumi, the elite swordsman of Japan's last shogun.
The Shinsengumi is popular among Japanese girls because its members were all young, in their teens to early 30s. They changed Japan. The interesting part of their era is that we can see some photos of them, so we can imagine them better and feel closer to them. This history gives courage to young people today.
In TV dramas, the Shinsengumi are all played by popular young male actors. The Rekijo history girls idolize these historical figures like rock stars. Ryo Watanabe, no relation to Anne, is one of the media and marketing entrepreneurs who have helped build the Rekijo phenomenon. He created this music, a website, TV shows, and a bar for Rekijo to congregate. Watanabe explains that history girls populate both virtual and actual worlds.
Virtual ones just play games and follow individual characters. The real ones start with games, but they also do research, read books, and visit historical sites. These are the real history girls.
Anthropologists who study such things say that the Rekijo are actually a kind of otaku, a nerdy sort of fan of Japanese comic books and video games, such as this samurai sword fighting game, which is a Rekijo favorite. Otaku nerds build identities for their favorite characters, choosing, for example, kimonos, hairstyles, and weapons, and giving their characters attributes, 3 points for strength and 4 for charisma. Patrick Galbraith is a PhD student at the University of Tokyo and author of the Otaku Encyclopedia. He says that the Rekijo history girls signal the rise of the female otaku. And what do male otakus do?
They're really kind of focusing on what types of women they're interested in. And they create this kind of fantasy discourse about the female, and they consume these fetishized fantasy images. And women also have been doing this for a very long time, but it's always been kind of below the surface.
People in Japan increasingly define themselves through the media they consume rather than work, family, or school ties. Of course, this is true elsewhere, but Galbraith says the 1990s decline of Japanese corporate culture has pushed the country's hobby culture into the mainstream.
Now we're seeing more and more people who are making connections through consumption, through shared media, through shared patterns of social existence. And maybe Reki Joe is one example of that, because really they are, I think, people who share an interest, but almost nothing else.
It's Wednesday night, and the Reki Joe history girls head down to Ryo Watanabe's bar to talk about warlords, sieges, assassins, and the like. In her metal-studded leather attire, Miyuki Miyamoto is dressed more for a mosh pit than a history seminar, and she's proud of it.
I like to be called Reki Joe. 10 years ago, I had a negative image as a serious, isolated girl who likes history but has few friends. Now, I feel more recognized as one of a group.
Observers note that even in the 19th century Edo era, Japanese grouped around pop culture experiences as a way of coping with the anonymity and solitude of urban life. The observer's point is that otaku culture's roots run deep in Japan, and that perhaps there's a little otaku in all of us. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.